You are not the last dream of my soul. You are the first dream, the only dream I ever was unable to stop myself from dreaming. You are the first dream of my soul, and from that dream, I hope will come all other dreams, a lifetime's worth. With hope at last, Will Herondale. She had sat up for a long time after that, holding the book without reading it, watching the dawn come up over London. In the morning, she had fairly flown to get dressed, before she seized up the book and dashed downstairs with it. She caught Will coming out of his bedroom, hair still damp from the pitcher, and hurled herself at him, catching his lapels and pulling him to her, burying her face in his chest. The book thumped to the floor between him, as he reached to hold her, smoothing her hair down her back, whispering softly, "Tessa, what is it? What's wrong? Did you not like..." "No one has ever written me anything so beautiful," she said, her face pressed against his chest, the soft beat of his heart steady beneath his shirt and jacket. "Not ever." "I wrote it just after I discovered the curse was false," Will said. "I had meant to give it to you, but..." His hand tightened in her hair. "When I found out you were engaged to Jem, I put it away. I did not know when I could, when I should give it to you. And then yesterday, when you wanted me to be myself, I had hope enough to take out those old dreams again, to dust them off, and give them to you." They went to the park that day, though it was as cold as it was bright, and there were not many people about. The Serpentine was bright under the wintry sun, and Will pointed out the place where he and Jem had fed poultry pies to the mallards. It was the first time she saw him smile while talking about Jem. She knew she could not be Jem for Will. No one could. But slowly, the hollow places in his heart were filling in. Having Cecily about was a joy for Will. Tessa could see that when they sat together before the fire, speaking Welsh softly, and his eyes glowed. He'd even grown to like Gabriel and Gideon, and they were friends for him, though no one could be a friend as Jem had been. And of course, Charlotte's and Henry's love was as steadfast as ever. The wound would never go away, Tessa knew, not for herself and not for Will either, but as the weather grew colder, and Will smiled more and ate more regularly, and the haunted look faded from his eyes, she began to breathe more easily, knowing that look was not a mortal one. "Hmm," he said now, rocking back in his heels slightly, as he surveyed the ballroom floor. "You may be right. I think it was around about Christmas when I got my Welsh dragon tattoo." At that, Tessa had tried very hard not to blush. How did that happen? Will made an airy gesture with his hand. "I was drunk." "Nonsense. You were never really drunk." "On the contrary, in order to learn how to pretend to be inebriated, one must become inebriated at least once, as a reference point. Six-fingered Nigel had been at the mulled cider." "You can't mean there's truly a six-fingered Nigel." "Of course there is," Will began with a grin, which suddenly faded. He was looking past Tessa, out at the ballroom. She turned to follow his gaze and saw the same tall, fair-haired man who had been talking to Charlotte earlier, shouldering his way through the crowd toward them. He was stocky, perhaps in his late 30s, with a scar that ran along his jaw. Tousled fairish hair and blue eyes, and skin tanned by the sun. It looked even darker against his starched white shirt front. There was something familiar about him, something that teased at the edges of Tessa's memories. He came to a stop in front of them. His eyes flicked to Will. They were a paler blue than Will's, almost the colour of cornflowers. The skin around them was tanned and lined with faint crow's feet. He said, "You are William Herondale?" Will nodded without speaking. "I am Elias Carstairs," the man said. "Jem Carstairs was my nephew." Will turned white, and Tessa realized what it was about the man that seemed familiar. There was something about him, something about the way he carried himself and the shape of his hands, that reminded her of Jem. Since Will seemed unable to speak, Tessa said, "Yes, this is Will Herondale, and I am Teresa Gray, the shape-changer girl," said the man. "Elias," Tessa reminded herself. Shadowhunters used each other's given names. "You were engaged to James before he became a silent brother."
"I was," Tessa said quietly. "I love him very much."
He gave her a look, not hostile or challenging, only curious. And then he turned his gaze to Will.
You were his parabatai.
Will found his voice.
I am still, he said, and set his jaw stubbornly.
James spoke of you, said Elias. After I left China, when I returned to Idris, I asked if he would come and live with me. We had sent him away from Shanghai, considering it unsafe for him there while Yen Lo's minions ran free, still seeking vengeance. But when I asked him if he would come to me in Idris, he said no, he could not. I asked him to reconsider, told him I was his family, his blood. But he said he could not leave his parabatai, that there were some things more important than blood.
Elias's light blue eyes were steady.
I have brought you a gift, Will Herondale. Something I intended to give him when he was of age, because his father no longer lived to give it to him. But I cannot give it to him now.
Will was tense all over, a bowstring strung too tight. He said, I have not done anything to deserve a gift.
I think you have.
Elias drew from the belt at his waist a short sword in an intricate scabbard. He held it out to Will, who, after a moment, took it. The scabbard was covered in intricate designs of leaves and runes, carefully worked, gleaming under the golden light. With a decisive gesture, Will pulled the sword free and held it up in front of his face. The hilt was covered with the same pattern of runes and leaves, but the blade itself was simple and bare, save for a line of words that ran down its center. Tessa leaned in to read the words upon the metal. I am Cortana, of the same steel and temper as Joyeuse and Durandal.
Joyeuse was Charlemagne's sword, said Will, his voice still stiff, in that way that Tessa knew now meant that he was forcing down emotion.
Durandal was Roland's. This sword is... it is of legend born.
Forged by the first shadow hunter weapon maker, Waylon the Smith. It is a feather from the wing of the angel in its hilt, said Elias. It has been in the Caster's family for hundreds of years. I was instructed by Jem's father to give it to him when he reached 18, but the Silent Brothers cannot accept gifts. He looked at Will.
You were his parabatai. You should have it.
Will slammed the sword back into its scabbard.
I cannot take it. I will not.
Elias looked stunned.
But you must, he said.
You were his parabatai, and he loved you. Will held the sword back out toward Elias Carstairs, hilt first. After a moment, Elias took it, and Will turned and walked away, vanishing into the crowd. Elias looked after him in bewilderment.
I did not intend to cause offense.
You spoke of Jem in the past tense, said Tessa. Jem is not with us, but he is not dead. Will, he cannot bear that Jem be thought of as lost or forgotten.
I did not mean to forget him, said Elias. I meant simply that the Silent Brothers do not have emotions like we do. They do not feel as we do. If they love...
Jem still loves Will, Tessa said, whether he is a Silent Brother or not. There are things no magic can destroy, for they are magic in themselves. You never saw them together, but I did.
I meant to give him Cortana, Elias said. I cannot give it to James, so I thought his parabatai ought to have it.
You mean well, Tessa said, but forgive my impertinence, Mr. Carstairs. Do you never mean to have any children of your own?
His eyes widened. I had not thought.
Tessa looked at the shimmering blade, and then at the man holding it. She could see Jem in him a little, as if she were looking at the reflection of what she loved in rippling water. That love, remembered and present, made her voice gentle when she spoke.
If you are not sure, she said, then keep it.
Keep it for your own ears.
Will would prefer that, for he does not need a sword to remember Jem by, however illustrious its lineage.
It was cold on the Institute steps, cold where Will stood without a coat or hat, looking out into the frost-dusted night. The wind blew tiny drifts of snow against his cheeks, his bare hands, and he heard, as he always did, Jem's voice in the back of his head, telling him not to be ridiculous,
to get back inside before he gave himself the flu. Winter had always seemed the purest season to Will, even the smoke and dirt of London caught by the chill, frozen hard and clean. That morning he had broken a layer of ice that had formed on his water jug, before splashing the icy fluid onto his face and shivering as he looked in the mirror, his wet hair painting his face in black stripes. First Christmas morning without Jem in 6 years. The purest cold, bringing the purest pain.
Will?
The voice was a whisper of a very familiar kind. He turned his head, an image of old Molly rising in his mind. But ghosts so rarely strayed from where they had died or were buried. And besides, what would she want with him now? A gaze met his, level and dark. The rest of her was not so much transparent as edged by silver. The blonde hair, the dull, pretty face, the white gown she had died in. Blood, red like a flower, on her chest.
"Jessamine," he said. "Merry Christmas, Will."
His heart, which had stopped for a moment, began to beat again, the blood running fast in his veins.
"Jessamine, what are you doing here?"
She pouted a little.
"I'm here because I died here," she said, her voice growing in strength.
It was not unusual for a ghost to achieve a greater solidity and auditory power when they were close to a human, especially one who could hear them. She indicated the courtyard at their feet, where Will had held her in the dying moments, her blood running onto the flagstones.
"You not pleased to see me, Will?"
"Should I be?" he said. "Jessie, usually when I see ghosts, it is because there is some unfinished business or some sorrow that holds them to this world." She raised her head, looking up at the snow. Though it fell all around her, she was untouched by it, as if she stood under glass.
"And if I had sorrow, would you help me cure it? You never cared for me much in life."
"I did," Will said. "I am truly sorry if I gave you the impression that I cared nothing for you, or hated you, Jessamine. I think you reminded me more of myself than I wish to admit, and therefore I judged you with the same harshness I would have judged myself." At that, she did look at him.
"Why, was that straightforward honesty, Will? How you have changed."
She took a step back, and he saw that her feet made no impression in the dusting of snow on the steps.
"I am here because in life I did not wish to be a shadow hunter, to guard the Nephilim. I am charged now with the guard of the Institute, for as long as it needs guarding."
"And you do not mind," he asked, "being here, with us, when you could have passed over?" She wrinkled her nose.
"I did not care to pass over. So much was demanded of me in life, the angel knows what it might be like afterwards. No, I'm happy here, watching you all, quiet and drifting and unseen."
Her silvery hair shone in the moonlight, as she inclined her head toward him.
"Though you are near to driving me mad."
"I?"
"Indeed. I always said you would be a dreadful suitor, Will, and you are nigh on proving it."
"Truly," Will said, "you've come back from death like the ghost of old Marley, but to nag me about my romantic prospects."
"What prospects?"
"You've taken Tessa on so many carriage rides. I'd wager she could draw a map of London from memory.
But have you proposed to her?"
"You have not."
"A lady cannot propose to herself, William, and she cannot tell you she loves you if you do not state your intentions."
Will shook his head.
"Jessamine, you are incorrigible."
"I am also right," she pointed out.
"What is it you are afraid of?"
"That if I do state my intentions, she will say she does not love me back, not the way she loved Jem."
"She will not love you as she loved Jem. She will love you as she loves you, Will, an entirely different person. Do you wish that she had not loved Jem?"
"No, but neither do I wish to marry someone who does not love me."
"You must ask her to find that out," said Jessamine. "Life is full of risks. Death is much simpler."
"Why have I not seen you before tonight, when you have been here all this time?" he asked.
"I cannot enter the Institute yet, and when you are out in the courtyard, you are always with someone else. I have tried to go through the doors, but a sort of force prevents me."
It's better than it was. At first I could go only a few steps. Now I am as you see me. She indicated her position on the stairs. One day I shall be able to go inside. And when you do, you shall find that your room is as it ever was, and your dolls as well, said Will. Jessamine smiled a smile that made Will wonder if she had always been so sad, or if death had changed her more than he had thought ghosts could be changed. Before he could speak again, though, a look of alarm crossed her face, and she vanished within a swirl of snow. Will turned to see what had frightened her off. The doors of the Institute had opened, and Magnus had emerged. He wore an astrakhan wool greatcoat, and his tall silk hat was already being spotted by the falling snowflakes. I should have known I'd find you out here, doing your best to turn yourself into an icicle, Magnus said, descending the steps until he stood beside Will, looking at the courtyard. Will did not feel like mentioning Jessamine. Somehow, he thought, she would not have wanted him to. Were you leaving the party, or just looking for me? Both, Magnus said, pulling on a pair of white gloves. In fact, I am leaving London. Leaving London? Will said in dismay. You can't mean that. Why wouldn't I? Magnus flicked a finger at an errant snowflake. It sparked blue and vanished. I am not a Londoner, Will. I have been stopping with Woolsey for some time, but his home is not my home, and Woolsey and I wear out each other's company after not much duration. Where will you go? New York? The new world? A new life? A new continent? Magnus threw his hands up. I may even take your cat with me. Charlotte says he's been mourning since Jem left. Well, he bites everyone. You're welcome to him. Do you think he'll like New York? Who knows? We'll find out together. The unexpected is what keeps me from stagnating. Those of us who do not live forever do not like change, perhaps as much as those of you who do. I'm tired of losing people, Will said. So am I, Magnus said. But it is as I said, isn't it? You learn to bear it. I have heard sometimes that men who lose an arm or a leg still feel the pain in those limbs, though they are gone, said Will. It is like that sometimes. I can feel Jem with me, though he is gone, and it is like I'm missing a part of myself. But you are not, Magnus said. He's not dead, Will. He lives because you let him go. He would have stayed with you and died if you'd asked it. But you loved him enough to prefer that he live, even if that life is separate from yours. And that, above all things, proves that you're not Sidney Carton, Will, that yours is not the kind of love that can be redeemed only through destruction. It is what I saw in you, what I've always seen in you, what made me want to help you, that you are not despairing, that you have in you an infinite capacity for joy. He put one gloved hand under Will's chin and lifted Will's face. There were not many people Will had to raise his head to look in the eye, but Magnus was one. Bright star, Magnus said, and his eyes were thoughtful, as if he were remembering something or someone. Those of you who are mortal, you burn so fiercely, and you, fiercer than most, Will. I will not ever forget you. Nor I you, said Will. I owe you a great deal. You broke my curse. You were not cursed. Yes, I was, Will said. I was. Thank you, Magnus, for all you did for me. If I did not say it before, I am saying it now. Thank you. Magnus dropped his hand. I don't think a shadow hunter has ever thanked me before. Will smiled crookedly. I would not try to become too accustomed to it. We're not a thankful sort. No, Magnus laughed. No, I won't. His bright cat eyes narrowed. I leave you in good hands, I think, Will Herondale. You mean Tessa? I do mean Tessa. Or do you deny that she holds your heart? Magnus had begun to descend the stairs. He paused and looked back at Will. I do not, Will said. But she will be sorry that you have left without saying goodbye to her. Oh, Magnus said, turning at the bottom of the steps with a curious smile. I don't think that will be necessary.
Tell her I will see her again. Will nodded. Magnus turned away, hands in the pockets of his coat, and began to walk toward the gates of the Institute. Will watched until his retreating figure faded into the whiteness of the falling snow.
Tessa had slipped out of the ballroom without anyone noticing. Even the usually keen-eyed Charlotte was distracted, sitting beside Henry in his wheeled chair, her hand in his, smiling at the antics of the musicians. It did not take Tessa long to find Will. She had guessed where he would be, and she was correct, standing on the front steps of the Institute, without a coat or hat, letting the snow fall on his head and shoulders. There was a white dusting of it all over the courtyard, like icing sugar, frosting the line of carriages waiting there, the black iron gates, the flagstones upon which Jessamine had died. Will was staring intently ahead of him, as if trying to discern something through the descending flakes. "Will?" Tessa said, and he turned up to look at her. She had caught up a silk wrap, but nothing heavier, and she felt the cool sting of snowflakes against the bare skin of her neck and shoulders. "I should have been more polite to Elias Carstairs," Will said, by way of reply. He was looking up at the sky, where a pale crescent of moon darted in between the thick sweeps of cloud and fog. Flakes of white snow had fallen and mixed with his black hair. His cheeks and lips were flushed with the cold. He looked more handsome than she had ever remembered him. "Instead, I behaved as I would have before." Tessa knew what he meant. For Will, there was only one before and after.
"You are allowed to have a temper," she said. "I've told you before, I do not want you to be perfect, only to be Will."
"Who will never be perfect."
"Perfect is dull," Tessa said, descending the last step to stand beside him. "They're playing Complete the Poetic Quotation inside now. You could have made quite a showing. I do not think there is anyone who could challenge your knowledge of literature, other than you."
"I would be difficult competition indeed. Perhaps we could make ourselves a team of sorts and divide the winnings."
"That seems bad form." Will spoke absently, tilting back his head now. The snow circled whitely about them, as if they stood at the bottom of a whirlpool.
"Today, when Sophie ascended."
"Yes."
"Is that something that you would have wanted?"
He turned to look at her, white snowflakes caught in his dark lashes.
"For yourself."
"You know that is impossible for me, Will. I am a warlock, or at least, that is the closest approximation of what I am. I cannot ever be fully Nephilim."
"I know."
He looked down at his hands, opening his fingers to let snowflakes settle, melting, on his palms.
"But in Cada Idris, you said that you hoped to be a shadow hunter, that Mortmain had dashed those hopes."
"I did feel that way, at the time," she allowed. "But when I became ethereal, when I changed and destroyed Mortmain, how could I hate something that allowed me to protect the ones I care about? It is not easy to be different, and even less so to be unique. But I begin to think I was never meant for an easy road."
Will laughed. "The easy road, no. Not for you, my Tessa."
"Am I your Tessa?"
She drew her wrap closer around herself, pretending her shiver was just the cold.
"Are you bothered by what I am, Will? That I am not like you?"
The words hung between them, unspoken. "There is no future for a shadow hunter who dallies with warlocks." Will paled. "Those things I said on the roof, so long ago. You know I did not mean them."
"I know.
I do not wish you other than you are, Tessa. You are what you are, and I love you. I do not just love the parts of you that meet with a Clave's approval."
She raised her eyebrows.
"You are willing to endure the rest?"
He raked a hand through his dark, snow-dampened hair.
"No, I am misspeaking. There is nothing about you that I can imagine not loving. Do you really think it is so important to me that you be Nephilim? My mother isn't a shadow hunter, and when I saw you change into the angel, when I saw you blaze forth with the fire of heaven, it was glorious, Tess."
He took a step toward her.
"What you are, what you can do, it is like some great miracle of the earth. Like fire or wildflowers, or the breath of the sea. You are unique in the world, just as you are unique in my heart. And there will never be a time when I do not love you. I would love you if you were not in any part a shadow hunter at all. She gave him a shaky smile. But I am glad that I am, if only by half, she said, since it means that I may stay with you, here, in the Institute. That the family I have found here can remain my family. Charlotte said if I choose, I could cease to be a Gray and take the name my mother should have had before she was married. I could be a Starkweather. I could have a true Shadow Hunter name. She heard Will exhale a breath. It came out a puff of white in the cold. His eyes were blue and wide and clear, fixed on her face. He wore the expression of a man who had steeled himself to do a terrifying thing and was carrying it through. Of course you can have a true Shadow Hunter name, Will said. You can have mine. Tessa stared at him, all black and white against the black and white snow and stone. Your name? Will took a step toward her. They stood face to face. Then he reached to take her hand and slid off her glove, which he put into his pocket. He held her bare hand in his fingers curved around hers. His hand was warm and calloused, and his touch made her shiver. His eyes were steady and blue. They were everything Will was. True and tender, sharp and witty, loving and kind. Marry me, he said. Marry me, Tess. Marry me and be Tessa Herondale, or be Tessa Gray, or whatever you wish to call yourself. But marry me, and stay with me, and never leave me, for I cannot bear another day of my life to go by that does not have you in it. The snow was swirling down around them, white and cold and perfect. The clouds above had parted, and through the gaps she could see the stars. Jem told me what Ragnfell said about my father, Will went on, that for my father there was only ever one woman he loved, and it was her for him, or nothing. You are that for me. I love you, and I will only ever love you until I die. Will. He bit his lip. His hair was thick with snow, his lashes starred with flakes. Was that too grand a statement? Did I frighten you? You know how I am with words. Oh, I do. I recall what you said to me once, Will went on, that words have the power to change us. Your words have changed me, Tess. They have made me a better man than I would have been otherwise. Life is a book, and there are 1,000 pages I have not yet read. I would read them together with you, as many as I can, before I die. She put her hand against his chest, just over his heart, and felt its beat against her palm, a unique time signature that was all its own. I only wish you would not speak of dying, she said. But even for that, yes, I know how you are with your words. And Will, I love all of them. Every word you say. The silly ones, the mad ones, the beautiful ones, and the ones that are only for me. I love them, and I love you. Will began to speak, but Tessa covered his mouth with her hand. I love your words, my Will. But hold them for a moment, she said, and smiled into his eyes. Think of all the words I have held inside all this time, while I did not know your intentions. When you came to me in the drawing room and told me that you loved me, it was the hardest thing I have ever done to send you away. You said you loved the words of my heart, the shape of my soul. I remember every word you said from that day to this. I will never forget them. There are so many words I wish to say to you, and so many I wish to hear you say to me. I hope we have all our lives to say them to each other. Then you will marry me, Will said, looking dazed, as if he did not quite believe in his good fortune. Yes, she said, the last, the simplest and most important word of all. And Will, who had words for every occasion, opened his mouth and closed it on silence, and instead reached for her to pull her against him. Her wrap fell onto the stairs, but his arms were warm around her, and his mouth hot against hers, as he slanted his head down to kiss her. He tasted like snowflakes and wine, like winter and Will and London. His mouth was soft against hers, his hands in her hair, scattering white berries across the stone steps. Tessa held fast to Will as the snow swirled around them. Through the windows of the Institute, she could hear the faint sound of the music playing in the ballroom. The pianoforte, the cello, and rising above it all, like sparks leaping toward the sky, the sweet, celebratory strains of the violin.
"I can't believe we're really going home," Cecily said. Her hands were clasped in front of her, and she was bouncing up and down in her white kid boots. She was bundled into a red winter coat, the brightest thing in the dark crypt, except the portal itself, great and silver and shining against the far wall. Through it, Tessa could catch a glimpse, like a glimpse in a dream of blue sky. The sky outside the Institute was a spitting London grey, and snow-dusted hills. Will stood beside her, his shoulder brushing hers. He looked pale and nervous, and she longed to take his hand. "We're not going home, Ceci," he said. "Not to stay. We're visiting. I wish to introduce our parents to my fiancé." And at that, his pallor faded slightly, his lips curving into a smile. "That they might know the girl I'm going to marry."
"Oh, pish-tosh," said Cecily. "We can use the portal to see them whenever we want. Charlotte is the consul, so we cannot possibly get in trouble."
Charlotte groaned. "Cecily, this is a singular expedition. It is not a toy. You cannot simply use the portal whenever you like, and this excursion must be kept a secret. None but we here can know you visited your parents, that I allowed you to break the law."
"I won't tell anyone," Cecily protested. "And neither will Gabriel."
She glanced at the boy at her side. "You won't, will you?"
"Why are we bringing him along again?" Will inquired, of the world in general as well as his sister.
Cecily put her hands on her hips.
"Why are you bringing Tessa?"
"Because Tessa and I are going to be married," Will said, and Tessa smiled. The way that Will's little sister could ruffle his feathers like no one else was still amusing to her.
"Well, Gabriel and I might well be married," Cecily said. "Someday."
Gabriel made a choking noise and turned an alarming shade of purple. Will threw up his hands.
"You can't be married, Cecily. You're only 15.
When I get married, I'll be 18, an adult."
Cecily did not look impressed.
"We may have a long engagement," she said, "but I cannot see why you're counseling me to marry a man my parents have never met."
Will sputtered.
"I'm not counseling you to marry a man your parents have never met." "Then we are in agreement. Gabriel must meet Mom and Dad."
Cecily turned to Henry.
"Is the portal ready?"
Tessa leaned close to Will. "I do love the way she manages you," she whispered. "It is quite entertaining to watch."
"Wait until you meet my mother," Will said, and slipped his hand into hers. His fingers were cold. His heart must have been racing.
Tessa knew he had been up all night. The idea of seeing his parents after so many years was as terrifying to him as it was joyful. She knew that admixture of hope and fear infinitely worse than just one alone.
"The portal is quite ready," said Henry. "And remember, in an hour I shall open it again, that you may return through it."
"And understand, this is just this once," Charlotte said anxiously. "Even if I am the consul, I cannot allow you to visit your mundane family."
"Not even at Christmas," said Cecily, with large, tragic eyes.
Charlotte weakened visibly.
"Well, perhaps Christmas."
"And birthdays," said Tessa.
"Birthdays are special."
Charlotte put her hands over her face.
"Oh, by the angel."
Henry laughed and swept an arm toward the door.
"Go on through," he said, and Cecily went first, vanishing through the portal as if she had stepped through a waterfall.
Gabriel followed, and then Will and Tessa, holding tightly to each other's hands. Tessa concentrated on the warmth of Will's hand, the pulse of blood through his skin, as the cold and darkness took them, whirling them about for breathless, ageless moments. Lights burst behind her eyes, and she emerged from the darkness suddenly, blinking and stumbling. Will caught her to him, keeping her from falling. They were standing on the wide curved drive in front of Ravenscar Manor. Tessa had seen the place only from above, when she and Jem and Will had visited Yorkshire together, not realizing that Will's family inhabited the house now. She recalled that the manor was held in the cup of a valley, with hills sweeping up on either side, covered in gorse and heather, patched now with a dusting of snow. The trees had been green then, they were leafless now, and from the dark slate roof of the manor hung sparkling icicles. The door was dark oak, a heavy brass knocker set in the centre. Will looked at his sister, who nodded minutely at him, then squared his shoulders and reached to lift and release it. The resultant crash seemed to echo through the valley, and Will swore under his breath. Tessa touched his wrist lightly with her hand. "Be brave," she said. "It's not a duck, is it?" He turned to smile at her, dark hair falling in his eyes, just as the door opened to reveal a neatly dressed parlourmaid in a black dress and white mob cap. She took one look at the group on the doorstep, and her eyes widened like saucers. "Miss Cecily," she gasped, and then her eyes went to Will. She clapped her hand over her mouth, turned, and bolted back into the house. "Oh dear," said Tessa. "I have that effect on women," Will said. "I probably should have warned you before you agreed to marry me." "I can still change my mind," Tessa said sweetly. "Don't you dare." He began with a breathless half-laugh, and then suddenly there were people at the door. A tall man, broad-shouldered, with a mass of fair hair streaked with grey and light blue eyes. Just behind him was a woman, slender and startlingly beautiful, with Will and Cecily's ink-black hair and blue eyes as dark as violets. She cried out the moment her gaze fell on Will, and her hands came up, fluttering like white birds startled by a gust of wind. Tessa released Will's hand. He seemed frozen, like a fox when the hounds were almost on him. "Go on," Tessa said softly, and he stepped forward, and then his mother was embracing him, saying, "I knew you'd come back. I knew you would," followed by a torrent of Welsh, of which Tessa could discern only Will's name. Their father was stunned but smiling, holding out his arms for Cecily, who went into them as agreeably as Tessa had ever seen her do anything. For the next few moments, Tessa and Gabriel stood awkwardly on the doorstep, not quite looking at each other, but not quite sure where else to look either. After a long moment, Will drew away from his mother, patting her gently on the shoulder. She laughed, though her eyes were full of tears, and she said something in Welsh that Tessa strongly suspected was a comment on the fact that Will was now taller than she was. "Little mother," he said affectionately, confirming Tessa's suspicions, and he swung around just as his mother's gaze fell on Tessa, and then Gabriel, her eyes widening. "Mom and Dad, this is Teresa Gray. We are engaged to be married next year." Will's mother gave a gasp, though she sounded more surprised than anything else, to Tessa's relief, and Will's father's gaze went immediately to Gabriel, and then to Cecily, his eyes narrowing. "And who is this gentleman?" Will's grin widened. "Oh, him," he said. "This is Cecily's friend, Mr. Gabriel Lightworm." Gabriel, half in the act of stretching out his hand to greet Mr. Herondale, froze in horror. "Lightwood," he spluttered. "Gabriel Lightwood." "Will," Cecily said, breaking away from her father to glare at her brother. Will looked at Tessa, his blue eyes shining. She opened her mouth to remonstrate with him, to say "Will," as Cecily had just done, but it was too late. She was already laughing. Epilogue. I say the tomb, which on the dead is shut, opens the heavenly hall. And what we hear, for the end of all things put, is the first step of all. Victor Hugo. A Villecure. London. Blackfriars Bridge, 2008. The wind was sharp, blowing grit and stray rubbish, crisp packets, stray pages of newspaper, old receipts, along the pavement as Tessa, glancing quickly from side to side to check for traffic, dashed across Blackfriars Bridge. To any onlooker, she would have looked like an ordinary girl, in her late teens or early 20s. Jeans tucked into boots, a blue cashmere top she'd gotten for half off during the January sales, and long brown hair, curling just a bit in the damp weather, tumbling haphazardly down her back. If they were particularly sharp-eyed about fashion, they would have assumed the paisley Liberty print scarf she wore was a knockoff instead of a 100-year-old original, and that the bracelet around her wrist was vintage rather than a gift that had been given to her by her husband on their 30th wedding anniversary. Tessa's steps slowed as she reached one of the stone recesses in the wall of the bridge. Cement benches had been built into them now, so you could sit and look at the grey-green water below, sloshing up against the bridge pilings, or at St. Paul's in the distance. The city was alive with noise. The sounds of traffic, honking horns, the rumble of double-decker buses, the ringing of dozens of mobiles, the chatter of pedestrians, the faint sounds of music leaking from white iPod earbuds. Tessa sat down on the bench, pulling her legs up under her. The atmosphere was shockingly clean and clear. The smoke and pollution that had rendered the air yellow and black when she'd been a girl here were gone, and the sky was the colour of a blue-grey marble. The eyesore that had been the Dover and Chatham Railway Bridge was gone too. Only the pilings were still sticking up out of the water as an odd reminder of what had once been. Yellow buoys bobbed in the water now, and tourist boats chugged by, the amplified voices of the tour guides blaring from their speakers. Buses as red as candy hearts sped along the bridge, sending dead leaves fluttering to the curb. She'd glanced down at the watch on her wrist. 5 minutes to noon. She was a little early, but then she always was for this, their yearly meeting. It gave her a chance to think and to remember, and there was no place better for doing either than here, on Blackfriars Bridge, the first place they had ever really talked. Beside the watch was the pearl bracelet she always wore. She never took it off. Will had given it to her when they had been married 30 years, smiling as he'd fastened it on. He had had grey in his hair then, she knew, though she had never really seen it. As if her love had given him his own shape-shifting ability, no matter how much time had passed, when she looked at him, she saw always the wild, black-haired boy that she had fallen in love with. It still seemed incredible to her, sometimes, that they had managed to grow old together, herself and Will Herondale, whom Gabriel Lightwood had once said would not live to be older than 19. They had been good friends with the Lightwoods, too, through all those years. Of course, Will could hardly not be friends with the man who was married to his sister. Both Cecily and Gabriel had seen Will on the day he died, as had Sophie, though Gideon had himself passed away several years before. Tessa remembered that day clearly, the day the Silent Brothers had said there was nothing more they could do to keep Will alive. He had been unable to leave their bed by then. Tessa had squared her shoulders and gone to give the news to their family and friends, trying to be as calm for them as she could, though her heart had felt as if it were being ripped out of her body. It had been June, the bright hot summer of 1937, and with the curtains thrown back, the bedroom had been full of sunlight. Sunlight and her and Will's children, their grandchildren, their nieces and nephews, Cessie's blue-eyed boys, tall and handsome, and Gideon and Sophie's two girls, and those who were as close as family, Charlotte, white-haired and upright, and the Fairchild sons and daughters with their curling red hair like Henry's had once been. All day Tessa had sat on the bed with Will beside her, leaning on her shoulder. The sight might have been strange to others, a young woman lovingly cradling a man who looked old enough to be her grandfather, her hands looped through his. But to their family, it was only familiar. It was only Tessa and Will. And because it was Tessa and Will, the others came and went all day, as shadowhunters did at a deathbed, telling stories of Will's life and all the things he and Tessa had done through their long years together. The children had spoken fondly of the way he had always loved their mother, fiercely and devotedly, the way he had never had eyes for anyone else, and how their parents had set the model for the sort of love they hoped to find in their own lives. They spoke of his regard for books, and how he had taught them all to love them too, to respect the printed page, and cherish the stories that those pages held.
They spoke of the way he still cursed in Welsh when he dropped something, though he rarely used the language otherwise, and of the fact that though his prose was excellent, he had written several histories of the Shadowhunters when he'd retired that had been very well respected. His poetry had always been awful, though that had never stopped him from reciting it. Their oldest child, James, had spoken laughingly about Will's unrelenting fear of ducks and his continual battle to keep them out of the pond at the family home in Yorkshire. Their grandchildren had reminded him of the song about demon pox he had taught them when they were much too young, Tess had always thought, and that they had all memorized. They sang it all together and out of tune, scandalizing Sophie. With tears running down her face, Cecily had reminded him of the moment at her wedding to Gabriel when he had delivered a beautiful speech praising the groom, at the end of which he had announced,
"Dear God, I thought she was marrying Gideon. I take it all back,"
thus vexing not only Cecily and Gabriel, but Sophie as well. And Will, though too tired to laugh, had smiled at his sister and squeezed her hand. They'd all laughed about his habit of taking Tessa on romantic holidays, to places from gothic novels, including the hideous moor where someone had died, a draughty castle with a ghost in it, and of course the square in Paris in which he had decided Sidney Carton had been guillotined, where Will had horrified passers-by by shouting, "I can see the blood on the cobblestones!" in French. At the end of the day, as the sky had darkened, the family had come around Will's bed and kissed him each in turn and left one by one, until Will and Tessa were alone together. Tessa had lain down beside him and slid her arm beneath his head and put her head on his chest, listening to the ever-weakening beat of his heart. And in the shadows, they'd whispered, reminding each other of the stories only they knew. Of the girl who had hit over the head with a water jug, the boy who had come to rescue her, and how he'd fallen in love with her in that instant. Of a ballroom and a balcony, and the moon sailing like a ship untethered through the sky. Of the flutter of the wings of a clockwork angel. Of the holy water and blood. Near midnight, the door had opened and Jem had come in. Tessa supposed she would have thought of him as Brother Zachariah by then, but neither Will nor Tessa had ever called him that. He had come in like a shadow in his white robes, and Tessa had taken a deep breath when she had seen him, for she had known that this is what Will had been waiting for, and that the hour was now. He did not come to Will at once, but crossed the room to a rosewood box that sat upon the top of the dresser. They'd always kept Jem's violin for him, as Will had promised. It was kept clean and in order, and the hinges of the box did not creak as Jem opened it and lifted the instrument out. They watched as he rosined the bow with his familiar slim fingers, his pale wrists disappearing down into the paler material of the brothers' parchment robes. He lifted the violin to his shoulder then, and raised the bow, and he played. Zhe Yin, Jem had told her once that it meant understanding music, and also a bond that went deeper than friendship. Jem played, and he played the years of Will's life as he had seen them. He played two little boys in a training room, one showing the other how to throw knives, and he played the ritual of Parabatai, the fire and the vows, and the burning runes. He played two young men running through the streets of London in the dark, stopping to lean up against a wall and laugh together. He played the day in the library when he and Will had jested with Tessa about ducks, and he played the train to Yorkshire, on which Jem had said that Parabatai were meant to love each other as they loved their own souls. He played that love, and he played their love for Tessa, and hers for them. And he played Will saying, "In your eyes I have always found grace." He played the too few times he had seen them since he had joined the Brotherhood, the brief meetings at the Institute, the time when Will had been bitten by a shack's demon and nearly died, and Jem had come from the Silent City and sat with him all night, risking discovery and punishment. And he played the birth of their first son and the protection ceremony that had been carried out on the child in the Silent City. Will would have no other silent brother but Jem perform it. And Jem played the way he had covered his scarred face with his hands and turned away when he'd found out that the child's name was James.
He played of love and loss and years of silence, words unsaid and vows unspoken, and all the spaces between his heart and theirs. And when he was done, and he'd set the violin back in its box, Will's eyes were closed, but Tessa's were full of tears. Jem set down his bow and came toward the bed, drawing back his hood so she could see his closed eyes and his scarred face. And he had sat down beside them, on the bed, and taken Will's hand, the one that Tessa was not holding. And both Will and Tessa had heard Jem's voice in their minds. "I take your hand, brother, so that you may go in peace." Will had opened the blue eyes that had never lost their color over all the passing years, and looked at Jem and then Tessa, and smiled, and died, with Tessa's head on his shoulder, and his hand in Jem's. It never had stopped hurting, remembering when Will had died. After he was gone, Tessa had fled. Her children were grown, had children of their own. She told herself that they did not need her, and hid in the back of her mind the thought that haunted her. She could not bear to remain and watch them grow older than she was. It had been one thing to survive the death of her husband. To survive the death of her children, she could not sit by and watch it. It would happen, must happen, but she would not be there. And besides, there was something Will had asked her to do. The road that led from Shrewsbury to Welshpool was no longer as it had been when Will had ridden across it in a mad, heedless dash to save her from Mortmain. Will had left instructions, details, descriptions of towns, of a certain spreading oak tree. She had puttered up and down the road several times in her Morris Minor before she'd found it, the tree, just as he had drawn it in the journal he had given her, his hand shaking a little but his memory clear. The dagger was there among the roots of the trees, which had grown around the hilt. She had had to cut some of them away and dig at the dirt and rocks with the trowel before she could free it. Jem's blade, stained dark now with weather and the passage of time. She had brought it to Jem that year on the bridge. It was 1937, and the Blitz had not yet come to level the buildings around St. Paul's, to strafe the sky with red fire and burn the walls of the city Tessa loved. Still, there was a shadow over the world, the hint of a coming darkness. "They kill each other and kill each other, and we can do nothing," Tessa had said, her hands on the worn stone of the bridge parapet. She was thinking of the Great War, of the spendthrift waste of life. Not a shadow hunt of war, but out of blood and war were demons born, and it was the responsibility of the Nephilim to keep demons from wreaking even greater destruction. "We cannot save them from themselves," Jem had replied. He wore his hood up, but the wind blew it back, showing her the edge of his scarred cheek. "There is something coming, a horror Mortmain could only have imagined. I feel it in my bones. No one can rid the world of all evil, Tessa." And when she drew his dagger, wrapped in silk, though still dirty and stained with earth and Will's blood, from the pocket of her coat and gave it to him, he bent his head and held it to him, hunching his shoulders over it, as if protecting a wound to his heart. "Will wanted you to see it," she said. "I know you cannot take it with you. Keep it for me. There may come a day." She did not ask him what he meant, but she kept it. Kept it when she left England, the white cliffs of Dover retreating like clouds in the distance as she crossed the channel. In Paris, she found Magnus, who was living in a garret apartment and painting, an occupation for which he had no aptitude whatsoever. He let her sleep on a mattress by the window, and in the night, when she woke up screaming for Will, he came and put his arms around her, smelling of turpentine. "The first one is always the hardest," he said.
"The first?"
"The first one you love who dies," he said. "It gets easier after." When the war came to Paris, they went to New York together, and Magnus reintroduced her to the city she had been born in, a busy, bright, buzzing metropolis she barely recognized, where motor cars crowded the streets like ants, and trains whizzed by on elevated platforms, She did not see Jem that year, because the Luftwaffe was strafing London with fire, and he deemed it too dangerous to meet. But in the years after...
Tessa?
Her heart stopped. A great wave of lurching dizziness passed over her, and for a moment she wondered if she were going mad. If after so many years the past and present had blended within her memories until she could no longer tell the difference. For the voice she heard was not the soft, silent voice within her mind of Brother Zachariah. The voice that had echoed in her head once a year for the past 130 years. This was a voice that drew out memories stretched thin by years of recollection, like paper unfolded and refolded too many times. A voice that brought back, like a wave, the memory of another time on this bridge, a night so long ago, everything black and silver, and the river rushing away under her feet. Her heart was pounding so hard, she felt as if it might break through her ribcage. Slowly she turned, away from the balustrade, and stared. He stood on the pavement in front of her, smiling shyly, hands in the pockets of a pair of very modern jeans. He wore a blue cotton jumper pushed up to the elbows. Faint white scars decorated his forearms like lacework. She could see the shape of the rune of quietude, which had been so black and strong against his skin, faded now to a faint imprint of silver.
"Jem?" she whispered,
realizing why she had not seen him when she'd been searching the crowd for him. She'd been looking for Brother Zachariah, wrapped in his parchment white robe, moving unseen through the throng of Londoners. But this was not Brother Zachariah. This was Jem. She couldn't tear her gaze away from him. She had always thought Jem was beautiful. He was no less beautiful to her now. Once he had had silver-white hair and eyes like grey skies. This Jem had raven-black hair, curling slightly in the humid air, and dark brown eyes, with glints of gold in the irises. Once his skin had been pale, now it had a flush of colour to it. Where his face had been unmarked before he'd become a silent brother, there were two dark scars, the first runes of the Brotherhood, standing out starkly and blackly at the arch of each cheekbone. Where the collar of his jumper dipped slightly, she could see the delicate shape of the Parabatai rune that had once tied him to Will, that might tie them still, if one imagined souls could be tied, even over the divide of death.
"Jem," she breathed again.
At first glance, he looked perhaps 19 years old or 20, a bit older than he had been when he had become a silent brother. When she looked more deeply, she saw a man, the long years of pain and wisdom at the back of his eyes. Even the way he moved spoke of the care of quiet sacrifice.
"You are..."
Her voice rose with wild hope.
"This is permanent? You are not bound to the Silent Brothers anymore?"
"No," he said. There was a rapid hitch in his breath. He was looking at her as if he had no idea how she would react to his sudden appearance. "I am not."
"The cure? You found it?"
"I did not find it myself," he said slowly. "But it was found. I saw Magnus in Alicante a few months ago. We spoke of you. He never said..." "He didn't know," Jem said. "It has been a hard year, a dark year for shadow hunters. But out of the blood and fire, the loss and sorrow, there have been born some great new changes." He held out his arms self-deprecatingly, and with a little amazement in his voice as he said, "I myself am changed."
"How?"
"I will tell you the story of it, another story of Lightwoods and Herondales and Fairchilds, but it will take more than an hour in telling, and you must be cold." He moved forward, as if to touch her shoulder, then seemed to remember himself, and let his hand fall. Words had deserted her. She was still feeling the shock of seeing him like this, bone deep. Yes. She had seen him every year, here in this place, on this bridge. But it was not until this moment that she realized how much she had been seeing a Jem transmuted. But this was like falling into her own past, all the last century erased, and she felt dizzy and elated,
and terrified with it. But after today?